Transracially adoptive parents need to really also know that going in with the mindset that your child's color is no different from any other child is naive, and it's something that an adoptive parent cannot afford to engage in.
Welcome to the Honestly Adoption Podcast, a show about adoption, foster care, advocacy, and becoming the best caregiver possible. Pull up a chair. We're glad you've joined us. Here are your hosts, Mike and Kristen Berry.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Honestly Adoption Podcast, and welcome to Season 28, Episode 257. And you're joining us for the third session of our series to end the year in 2022 called The Insight Archives. We're replaying some of our favorite sessions from our 2021 and 2022 Insight Virtual Conference. And the cool part is that right after the new year, we're going to be announcing our 2023 lineup for Insight Virtual Conference 2023. So we're really excited about that. And we wanted to replay these special episodes for you. We've already replayed a session that Kristen and I did for this past year's conference, all about managing crisis. Last week was our good friend Chuck Hagley, who talked about navigating the online world with vulnerable children. And today, we're airing an episode from the 2021 Insight Virtual Conference from our good friend Lihia Cushman. She talks about how transracial adoptive families can thrive, and you're going to love her episode. You're going to love her presentation. And here's the other cool thing. Right now, until the end of the year, at the stroke of midnight on December 31st into a brand new year, we're giving you full access to both the 2021 and 2022 Insight Virtual Conference replays for a special price of just $29.95. That's right. You heard me right. Both session replays, that's the limited time access, but you can also get the lifetime access for just $59.95. That's both conference replays. All you need to do to take advantage of that is jump over to honestlyadoption.com/insight, and you'll learn all about it. That's how you sign up. So make sure you take advantage of that special offer. And if you're brand new to the show, welcome to you. Make sure you visit honestlyadoption.com/podcast to learn more about what we do and even get caught up on past episodes. If you are just joining us for this special series, make sure you jump over there and catch up on the last two episodes. We're glad you're here, whether you're brand new or you've been listening for a long time, your family, your friends. So welcome to you. And now on with the show.
Hello, everyone. My name is Lihia Cushman, and this is my very first time attending the Insight Conference, and I am so excited to not only get to be an attendee, but to also be a participant and share some of our really wild and crazy transracial adoption stories. So I'm hopeful that you will learn more about who we are as a family, but most importantly, take away some really key things to continue to think on as you evolve and grow and get empowered in your transracial adoption experience. So let's get going. As I mentioned earlier, my name is Lihia Cushman. I am an adoptive mother, but I've also been an adoption professional for close to 18 years, where I have really grown and had access to extensive trauma training, trainings on how to support families post-adoption. But the transracial adoption experience kind of gets lumped into all adoptions. And I think that as a profession and as a country, we need to do better with that. And so that's why I'm so passionate about sharing this particular part of our story. I would like to warn you all that some of the stories I'll share today may be a bit triggering or jarring, but that there are true stories and there are things that really happen to us. And so we'll start our day with just, you know, I think we're all pretty much experts, especially if we've adopted transracially, on what transracial adoption means. So we'll spend a very short time in there just kind of talking about what is the definition for the purpose of this discussion. And then I'm going to take a deep dive into four stories that may shed some light on how we navigated or experienced transracial adoption, especially in the Deep South where we were living. And then hopefully, as we share, as I share, we'll go from trying versus thriving. And how did my family get to thriving in our transracial adoption experience? And those will be the 7 ways that I kind of break down on today's presentation. And so I hope that in the end, we will realize that in all of this, right, we were all called in some way, shape, or form to this world of adoption. And how do we now navigate race, grace, and Jesus in a time that is so complex and so overloaded with information? So what, just take a minute and think, what is transracial adoption? What does it mean to you when you think about the words, or when you share with others, like, we are a transracial adoptive family? And for the purposes of this conference, of this conversation we're going to have today, I want you to simplify the definition in your mind to this. Transracial adoption occurs when a child of a different race or ethnicity is different from that of the parents that adopted them. So for example, our son is multiracial, but my husband is white and I am Afro-Latina. And in that process, in that progress, in that gelling together of a family, we had to realize very, very quickly that we are a transracial adoptive family, that our son's genetic makeup, that his ethnic makeup, that his racial background does not align with ours, and that there are experiences unique to him, unique to myself, and unique to my husband that somehow we have to make sense of and figure out, how do we navigate our life with this version of family that we have created? So I am a research junkie, and so bear with me, the next couple of slides really just shed some light on what does it really truly mean to navigate transracial adoption in the United States, and what is the data telling us about how we adopt in our country, and who's adopting? I love the Donaldson Adoption Institute, because they did such a deep dive for many, many years on the needs of transracially adopted children and their families. And this is one of the outcomes that has always resonated with me from their work and their deep dive. And it says, while transracial adoptions can provide much needed homes for boys and girls who may not otherwise have them, it is important to address the very real challenges in order to best serve everyone involved, especially the children. So today, I'm going to take the time to address some of the very real challenges I've experienced, and probably some of you have as well. And then where do we go from here? Okay, we know what we've experienced. How do we take that and evolve it into something new? So what does research tell us? In 2014, the research told us that in the entire United States, 15% of the children in the United States were children of color, primarily Black children. But they also accounted for 24% of the children in foster care. And this term is known as disproportionality. I share this with you today because I think it's important for us to understand how we got here. And this is one of the ways that we got here. More children of color, proportion size, more children of color in care, more children of color not being reunified, therefore more children of color being adopted. A 2007 survey of adoptive parents, which was sponsored by the Department of Health and Families and Human Services, indicated that 40% of adoptions in the United States, regardless of the type of adoption, were transracial. And specifically, that 40% of adoptions that were transracial composed of a white family, white parents with children of color. So I point this point out because this is why we're having this conversation today. This is why this conversation resonates with so many. When we have 40% of children being adopted into white families, and we're not being prepared for the racism that we will now step into, that you will now step into by adopting a child that doesn't look like you, it can be jarring and shocking. And I don't think child welfare has done a really good job of, in our work, in preparing families for that type of interaction. New survey came out by the same organization, the Department of Health and Human Services, just recently in 2020. And they said that in 2005 to 2007 and 2017 to 2019, the number of transracial adoptions increased by 58%. So remember what I said in point one. Point one says 40% of all adoptions, regardless of type, since 2007, that has jumped to 58% of adoptions in these United States are transracial adoptions, primarily composed of white adoptive couples and children of color. That's why we're having this conversation today. Because I think that although this looks good, I don't know that we've all been prepared to engage in that conversation. And I loop myself into that as well, because I am a transracial adoptive parent. My son, his ethnicity and race is not the same as mine, is not the same as my husband. So I had to learn fairly quickly. There were things that I was going to say as my son grew that may be offensive to him. There were things my husband was going to say that may be offensive to him. And so we wanted to start the work early on to figure out, how do we do this differently? And how do we grow from this process? And so why should we as parents, and what should we as parents know about adopting transracially? I love this quote because it's really helped me as I train families across the country, as I help families kind of figure out, who am I in this process? And know this, that the desire to love a child of a different race must also be matched with your willingness to learn and accept the unique needs of that race, of your child's race. So what does that mean? It means that it's not only making sure that you know how to take care of your child's hair, right? It's not just their skin. It's not just knowing and getting books of Black and brown children. It goes deeper than that. And that's the deep dive I want us to take today. That's the journey I want to take you on today. And then transracially adoptive parents need to really also know that going in with the mindset that your child's color is no different from any other child is naive, and it's something that an adoptive parent cannot afford to engage in. I say this because I have trained hundreds, if not maybe thousands, of adoptive parents across the country. And one of the things that always surprises me is when a family says, "We don't see color," and they're a transracially adoptive parent. Remember, I said early on, we were going to have some hard conversations today, and this is one of them. As a believer, as a Christian, I am fully aware that God created all colors and all ethnicities in His beautiful light, in His beautiful creation. And so if we believe scripture to be true, and if we believe that the God that we served created all of us and sees us all and loves us all, then, and He sees us, then we cannot ignore who our children are, what they look like, how they are perceived in our community, what are the laws that will impact them as they grow and evolve and become adults. That's the work. That's the work that I want to shed some light on today. So let me start with our story. First of all, how did I, this handsome fellow and I meet? We actually met, he came to help me move into my new apartment. And he was helping a friend help me move, and we have been inseparable ever since. That was in 1997. In 1999, we were married. And at the time, my husband was in the military, which meant that I would have to leave my bubble of living in Manhattan. I am the daughter of immigrants. And when my parents came to the United States, they migrated to New York City, where they built their life there and raised us kids there. And I will forever be thankful to them for that, because it made me who I am today. And so I am one of six children. Crazy, I know. But over time, I think that one of the things that has been so meaningful for me as a woman of color, as an Afro-Latina, is that family is everything. And incorporating our son into our family was huge for us as well. My husband, originally a Southern boy from New Orleans, was raised in New Jersey. And his parents also, his father had a job where they traveled a lot, which is how they ended up where in New Jersey. And subsequently, we met, fell in love, and have been married for 21 years. Early on in our marriage, we knew that we would struggle with infertility. And that's a whole nother conversation I can have at a separate time. But we, after multiple fertility treatments and multiple failed fertility treatments, we finally became pregnant. And 3 months later, miscarried. And it was pretty tragic. And at the time, I was an adoption social worker. And so while on my medical leave, my mom came to visit. And she asked me if I wanted to be pregnant or if I wanted to be a mom. And that stuck with me. And in the end, what I realized was I wanted to be a mom. And so we decided that adoption would be the route that we would take. We would take a break from fertility treatments and just kind of live our life and get back to some sort of normalcy for us. Any of you who out there who have done that know that the treatments are brutal, it's tough, it's emotionally taxing. And so for us, it was critical to just move beyond that season of our life. And 2 months after we decided we wanted to adopt, we were introduced through our adoption attorney to a very pregnant 7.5 month woman who we grew to love during that season. I got to go through medical appointments with her. We created a plan with the hospital on what would our adoption look like? How would we navigate that in real life? I was scared to death. My husband was too. And our son was born 20 days early. And let's just say we were sort of ready, but not fully. But this is our very first family, as a very first photo as a family. I was in the delivery room. I was able to cut the cord. And that night I sat with her and him in our hospital room, and we exchanged some beautiful, hard stories about her life, things that I carry with me that I share with our son as he grows. And this is who we are, a multiracial, transracial adoptive family. And at the time, we were living in North Carolina in a pretty rural area. So we were in the Deep South, just trying to figure out how do we do this in a way that can really help us thrive. And so I'm going to share 4 stories with you today that, again, some may be disturbing, but I think it sheds light on this much needed conversation. So I've spent a lot of time doing work and researching and figuring out who am I as a woman of color, as an adoptive mom, as an adoption professional. And God really called me to do the work, right? Read all the books, do the research, dig into scripture, and figure out who do we want to be as a family. What I didn't feel prepared for was how the community would engage with us as a family. And I think that that's the whole reason why I have really made it a point in my career to talk a lot about justice, grace, Jesus, and transracial adoption, because they all are interconnected, they all intersect, and I'll share with you today some of those examples. The first one is, where did you get that baby? So when we brought Jaden home from the hospital, he was premature. He was about 5 pounds. but as he grew and developed, he went in 1 month's time to the 75th percentile in weight. I mean, this kid could eat. But I decided while I was on maternity leave to just put him in the stroller. And although it was cold outside, let's go for a walk, get out of the house for a bit. I needed it. I was a new mom, and he definitely needed to just look at trees and sit in the stroller. Now, I want to preface this with this. When we decided to adopt, when we became pregnant, we had shared it with everyone. And when we miscarried, then we had to share it with everyone. And so what we decided was adoption was a huge risk, and we really didn't want to have to explain to everyone if the adoption fell through or if it didn't work, if we didn't finalize the adoption. Or if mom changed her mind, which was well within her rights, of course. And so we decided to keep it private. We only shared it with our intimate family and friends and went from there. So our neighbors didn't know. So flash forward to, I'm walking out of the house. I have this very chunky, what appeared to be a white baby in my stroller. And my neighbor had never seen me pregnant. So definitely a surprise to her. So here's what happened. She sees me walking. She's in the home across the street from me. And she says, "Hey, where'd you get that baby?" I'm sitting there and I'm just kind of like, did she just say what I think she said? And so I quickly remembered, oh gosh, I didn't tell her we were adopting. Let me just walk over to her and kind of let her know that we're adopting. I thought it was kind of like a joke. And I said, "I'm sorry," as I'm walking closer. "I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. What did you say?" And she goes, "Where'd you get that baby?" And now she was a little bit more aggressive, a little bit more frustrated. And honestly, guys, I got a little nervous. I said, "Well, we adopted our son, or we are in the process of adopting our son. And, you know, he means the world to us. So here we are. We want to share with you some of, you know, where we're at. And, you know, we're still in the process of finalizing, but we're getting there." And as I hear myself explaining all these things to her, I'm like, oh my gosh, why am I explaining myself in this way? But I knew that it just didn't feel safe. So I said to her, "No, you know, I'll see you later. I gotta go." So I take him for about a 20-minute walk, get back to my house, and there is the sheriff's department is parked in my driveway. And I'm floored. What is going on? What is happening? I thought maybe my husband was at work. I thought maybe something happened to my husband. So as I approach the police officer, he says to me, "Hey, ma'am, we've received a complaint that, you know, there was some suspicious activity in your home. I'd like to ask you, where did you get that baby?" And guys, even when I say it now, that's when I think I got really scared. That's when I realized I'm going to have to do things differently as I walk with my son down the street. So I said to him, if he allowed me to go into the home, I would bring out my our adoption paperwork and also my badge for my job. So he worked for the county as I did. So we're both county professionals. And so I explained to him, you know, we're adopting. And he immediately sees the paperwork, looks at my ID, and is immediately, "I am so sorry, ma'am. This will never happen again. My apologies. Congratulations," you know. And he starts to walk off. And I believe he's walking to his car, and he doesn't. He walks over to the porch of my neighbor and says, "Auntie, she's adopting that baby." So my neighbor called the police on me because she thought I had stolen a white baby. Are we prepared for that? I think some of that is because I am a woman of color. But some of it is not understanding that families look different and that we need to acknowledge that and be okay with that. The first time, I'll move on to the next story. The first time my son was called the N-word, he was 7. And the child that did it was 4 years old. And he was in summer camp. And I'll never forget the director calling me. I was at work to tell me that this incident had happened. And immediately, she began to defend the 4-year-old child. They don't know what they're doing. They don't know what they, you know, what he was saying. And again, I've been a social worker for a long time. I do this work because I love children, and I understand the developmental needs of a four-year-old. I also know that he was very well aware that the N-word was to be applied to Black and brown children. So that, for me, felt like it was something that needed to be addressed, at the very least with parents. At the very least, there should be a consequence for what this family was teaching their child. But there were none. I asked to speak with the family because I thought maybe I could educate them on, one, the offense, and two, you know, how do we move beyond this? I'm all about collaboration and empowerment and connectedness. And the family did not want to meet with us. They said it was harmless. The summer camp also felt that it was harmless. And, you know, I think the hardest part, aside from our son being called the N-word, was then something I was ill-equipped or unprepared to do was to explain to my seven-year-old what the N-word meant, how it applied to him, and what the child might have been trying to say to him. And that night, as my son cried himself to sleep because he realized for the first time, people will hate me just because I was born. That was tough. So how do we have those conversations with our kids? Additionally, the third story I'd like to share briefly is that my husband, same summer camp, my husband would pick him up and during half a day and take him to go get pizza. Same pizza shop we had frequented our entire life in North Carolina with our child. And it was hard because that day my husband was dressed up from work. He had just gotten off of work, picked up our son, went to grab a bite to eat. And when he got there, you know, Jay is referring to him as daddy, daddy, daddy. Anybody who knows my son knows he's not a quiet kid. I'm still trying to teach him at 15 what an inside voice is. So surely she heard it. But the server immediately wanted to say to my husband, it's so great that there are case managers like you who care for these types of kids. And so he politely, you know, redirected her and kind of explained, no, he's our son. This is my son. And I don't know if you've heard him saying to daddy, daddy, daddy to me over and over again, what, since we've been here, and we've come here many, many times. So I'm kind of shocked and appalled and surprised that you would assume I was his case manager because I'm dressed up and he's in summer clothes. She didn't apologize. She said, so what would you like to order? Clearly a message, clearly something that, you know, could have offended our son, but luckily he was on an iPad, so that helped. and then dinner dates. This is a really short one. The whole time we lived in the South, before we moved here to Tampa, Florida, one of the experiences that we had for the 14, 16 years we lived there was that we were always given separate checks at dinner as a family. Or we were always asked separate checks because no one saw us as a family. And I don't know how many times that's happened to you or how you've navigated that. But I would definitely love for you guys to share your experiences and to help. Let's help each other grow in this, because this is really happening. It really happened to our family. And, you know, I always say respect and validation is important. But if we don't validate people's experiences and we don't try to explain them away, well, I can kind of see why the lady called, you know, people do steal babies, you know, that kind of thing is not validating. It's really, and if we do it to our children who are experiencing racism on the daily, then we don't become safe spaces for them. We don't become allies for them in this. So that's some of our stories. This is a cute picture of my little guy when he was a little guy. He was, I would say right here, he was about 6 or 7. So this would have been around the time that we had to sit with him and explain the N-word. Not fun at all. Definitely not fun. So one of the things I do want to say, because I think it's important that we share where kids are when they are, identifying race. I've heard so many families over the years as I train them and teach them and coach them that we don't see race, we don't see color, the color blindness approach. But in addition to that, our kids don't understand that. They're too young to understand race and diversity and all of those pieces. And I'm here to tell you that that's not actually true. At the very earliest age of 3, children are able to define that they're different from other people. So that was during the season. My son, I'll use him as an example, would say to us, "Mommy, you're the color of chocolate. Daddy, you're the color of white milk. And I am the color, and I am caramel." And that was at 3. By the age of 7 and 11, kids are really trying to figure out, okay, this is my race, this is my ethnicity, this is how I identify. What are the negative connotations attached to that? What are some positive things attached to that? And then how do I want to move in this world? So that's when you see our kids taking a deep dive into TV shows and YouTube and social media and trying to figure out, like, who am I in this great big world? And then, of course, from ages 12 to 18, they're telling you what they believe in to be true, what systems they wish that they could change. And we either come alongside them in those things or we push them aside, don't validate, don't respect their experience, and don't advocate for them. Our biggest job is to be our child's ally and advocate until they can do it for themselves in adulthood. So a child's racial identity is developed very early on, younger than we thought. So now it's time to get into the work that I talked about that we would be doing today. So I want you to ask yourself these 3 questions. Number 1, are you currently an actively anti-racist parent? What does that mean? That means that not only are you talking on the regular with your child about race, not just when they bring it up, but when you have thoughts about it and how that impacts you, but are you also calling out racist tendencies, systems, and behaviors in a way that's healthy and that your children can see it? Kids learn by what they see, how we model things for them. So how do we make space for that for our children? Second question I want you to ask yourself is, do you currently live in a diverse community? Look around at your neighborhood, look around at your friends, look around in your community and just figure out who lives near me, who is in my, gated community, or who's in my subdivision, an apartment complex, who lives there? And then the final question I want you to ask yourself is, do you currently have a diverse group of friends? I want you to just take a minute. This is where we kind of jump over this, and I don't want to miss this. Take a minute and just think of your 5 closest friends. Who are they? What is their racial makeup? What is their ethnic makeup? Are they people that can help you in parenting your child? Are there people in your life that look like your children that you love and that your children love? And if not, how are you going to make space for that? Because that is critical. So why is it critical? Let's look around. Let's see what we find. So why would you talk with your child about race anyway? Why does that matter? How does that impact your child's ability to communicate with you? So the first reason why it's critical to talk to your child about being of a different race than you is because there are key life skills for transracially adopted children that gives them the ability to cope with the discrimination. And I'm gonna say something a little tough here. If we fail as transracial adoptive parents to have conversations ongoing with our children about race, we are setting them up to fail. And it's almost a form of, some may feel ill-equipped to face the things that will come in college, in middle school, in high school, at gymnastics camp. It will impact them. It's critical to have this conversation. Also, another reason to have conversations with the children about race is because they're learning to deal with prejudice. And it's particularly important when adoptees belong to racial groups that experience significant discrimination. So when we talk about Asians right now, when we talk about children of color, Latinos, African American, these are groups that are typically that typically experience significant discrimination. And in recent years, it has become even more and more violent. So how are we having those conversations with our children? And then another reason to talk about race with your child is because you want to minimize racial, you want to make sure that you're not minimizing the racial difference, because it's not going to disappear. It's not going to disappear. Your child's racial makeup is not going to disappear, and how the world treats them, it's not going to necessarily change. And remember, the colorblind approach doesn't work. I find that families who take on that perspective, we're all the same. It's almost a cop-out to not have the hard conversation that is necessary. And I feel like oftentimes these are also the families that wait for their children to bring up issues on race. My son will tell you, I don't wait. I bring it up any chance I get. And sometimes he's listening intently and taking things back with him. And sometimes he's not. But at least he knows he can come to us and we can have those hard talks. So what do we do to thrive? I want to be clear as I share this with you, because I think many times we get so caught up on what is the key remedy. Give me the six things to success. Give me the five things to success. And really, really, really what I want you to take away from this is that in actuality, we are all on a journey together, but we also have our own unique needs. So in order to thrive, these are the things that were specific to our family and the things that really helped us change how we were navigating. So I want to say this. Transracially adopted children and their families face challenges. We know that. And the way that parents, specifically parents, handle these challenges either hinders our children's development or facilitates it. It strengthens it. I don't know about you, but I didn't adopt my son to hinder his development, to impact negatively his well-being. I adopted him to help him thrive in ways that can change the world. And so, as adoptive parents, we need to know that our best intentions must be followed up with action. That's why I chose this specific photo for this slide. This is a photo of my son hugging his first mom. This is action and love, that we made space for him to have this connection because it was safe, but also because he desperately needed to know his people. He desperately needed to know she loved him. And we took the action to make that happen. And I remember taking this photo and feeling all kinds of emotions, all kinds of emotions. But the biggest emotion I felt was joy, because I mean, look at his face. So when we take action and we help our children connect the dots, there will be true joy and true peace found in those moments.
Hey everybody, I hope you're enjoying this amazing episode with our good friend Lihia Cushman. She is a wealth of knowledge. We absolutely love her presentation and love her heart. But listen, I wanted to jump in here real quick and remind you that you can get special access to our entire 2021 and 2022 Insight Virtual Conference replay libraries for just $29.95 for the limited time access or $59.95 for the lifetime access. We're giving this as a special gift to our listeners as we close out 2022. And all you need to do to take advantage of this special offer is jump over to honestlyadoption.com/insight and register today, enroll today, and we will send you both replay libraries. It is more than 20, I think over 25 hours of training content, and you get certificates of completions for your foster care training hours or your home study training hours. So don't miss this special opportunity. Visit honestlyadoption.com/insight today to take advantage. You have until December 31st, 1 week away, to take advantage of this. And now back to the show.
So here are the six ways that we as a family found ways to thrive: community, trauma, culture, environment, action, and discomfort. Community. I want to take some time and just talk a little bit about community, because I think that we miss very important pieces when we do this. Oftentimes we think of community as, you know, who we live life with, who we do life with, and who, you know, spends time with us. For me, this was big. I lived in, as I mentioned, we were raising our son in what we thought was a great community, a great small town to raise kids. And it was, but it wasn't necessarily for our multiracial child. And I think that when you're looking at the places you live, the spaces you're in, the churches you attend, are there things that people are going to say that are going to be disruptive and offensive? Absolutely. Racist? Absolutely. But are there people that look like your children? Are there people that can help you weigh, you know, level out the conversation? For us, it really became about who lives life with us. When I looked around in my season in North Carolina, I was really proud and excited that I had a plethora of diverse friends that came to the house often, that poured into our son. Some of them were adoptive parents. Some of them were adoptive professionals. Some of them were my friends from church. But I'll tell you, we really believed that living in our community was safe, was a safe, great place to raise our son, but it wasn't great for our family. It's still a beautiful place. It's still gorgeous. It still has really great people, but it wasn't safe for our family. And so we made a decision, a hard decision, to sell our home, to sell our cars, to apply for new jobs, and in many ways start our careers over in a whole new city. And we landed in Tampa, and I'll tell you, there was a lot of prayer that went into that. There was a lot of, are we doing the right thing? We're moving him away from his first family. Those things became real. But I can tell you now, 3 years in, 3 years from that decision, that it was the best thing we could have done for our family. The best thing we could have done for our family. Because our son now sees himself in his community. He sees himself in his teachers. And he sees himself in his friends. And I think because of that, we are able to see growth, a different kind of growth in him that I know we wouldn't have been able to see in North Carolina. Environment. Again, I just mentioned that we relocated, but I wanna pose some questions to you as a family. Do you prioritize diversity? And if you do, what does that look like? I say that because as adoptive parents, our environment often looks like what's comfortable for us as parents. But how would your life drastically change if you took the time to figure out, is this a safe environment for our child emotionally? Can we meet their needs emotionally in this environment we have created for our child? Is it, again, I'm gonna go back to what I just said in the previous slide. A small town is great. And yes, it is a great place to raise children. But is it a great place to raise all children? Is the question that I would like for you to pose today, that I would like to pose today. It was a question I posed for myself. And I knew that not only did my environment have to change, I didn't even realize, guys, how often, how much I was trying to keep up and was struggling internally myself with this idea that not everyone in my community looked like me, that I was cognizant every time I took a step in one direction or another that people were staring at me. I don't experience that, not to that degree, here in Tampa, Florida. Also, churches are a big deal, guys. And I know that, you know, a lot of us in this space right now are believers. A lot of us were called to adoption in one way or another. And our faith has been a big part of that. How are our churches able to meet the needs spiritually, emotionally, of all children, not just the children, the majority of the children in that community, but all children? So when George Floyd passed away and the world was kind of, a big part of the world was awoken to this level of pain that people of color have been enduring for quite some time, I waited to see how my church would respond. And for us, for our church, it was a critical conversation. I attend a multi-generational, multi-ethnic church. And our pastors stepped in into that darkness and helped us have really hard conversations about where we want to be as a church, but also how do we want to serve the community? And I think that that's part of the conversation today. Are you, as an adoptive parent of a transracially adopted child, prioritizing diversity? If your home is the only diverse space you have, how does that feel for your child? And what are the implications? Culture. I love this one because I am, as I shared earlier, an Afro-Latina. And what does that mean? That means that I was born to immigrants from another country, the Dominican Republic, and the very first language I learned to speak was Spanish. So for me, culture is huge. For my parents, building culture was easy. I lived in their home, and when I was in their home, I was in the Dominican Republic, basically. And when I exited their home to go to school or hang out with friends, I entered America. And in those two spaces, that's what kids who are adopted, transracially, when we're talking about that 58%, this is something that they lose. Something that I had that my son may not necessarily have in the same way. So when you grow up separated from your culture of origin, you need supplements to bridge that. And I think that parents need to stand in that gap and bridge those connections for our children. So yeah, granted, you're not gonna know all the things you don't know, but are there people in your community that can build that bridge, that connector for your child? That's how we stand in the gap. For us, I had to do a deep dive into not just Black history, but white history, and who and how does that connect and intersect for our son? And have real conversations about, you come from two worlds, but the world may only see you as someone who comes from one world. And what do we do with that? I think those are the pieces that are really critical for us to discuss. And then here are a few takeaways that I think would be really important as we have this conversation. Learn as an adoptive parent, if you want to build culture, learn what is presently important for your child's specific race and ethnicity. Learn what are the systems, the laws, the practices that will impact them. Take some time to give real life access to your child's culture. And specifically for Black children adopted transracially, teach them or hire someone to teach them how to take care of their hair and their skin. And don't do it one time. I say do it consistently. That's a big part of where a child of color's pride comes from. And I think that for me has been key. I got it wrong, guys, in the beginning. I have to be honest, but we systematically figured out we need to find a Black barber who can do his hair and teach him how to care for it. And that's what we did. And that barber not only became a connection of a, of a Black male role model for our son, but then he also became kind of part of our family. And in relocation, we lost that, but we had to find a new one, and we did. And that has changed everything for us as well. And then take time to watch beloved movies of your child's culture of origin. Netflix has a plethora of these. My favorite currently is Harriet Tubman. I learned so much that I hadn't learned in schools about who she truly was as a woman of God, and why she had this calling on her life led to all the doors that the Lord opened for her. And it can show our kids to have hope in hopeless situations. Trauma. You know, when I think about trauma, I often think about safety, respect, and validation. Those are key things when we're talking about trauma. But I think that in child welfare, in adoption, in foster care, when we're talking about trauma, we're talking about the mental state of children. We're talking about violence that was put upon them, whether through sexual abuse or physical or both, right? We're talking about the neglect that they have experienced, especially for children who have been adopted from the foster care system. But what if racial trauma is also very real? And it's also something we are not addressing with our children in our child welfare systems. What if the trauma of racism requires us to give our children safety, emotionally safe spaces, that it gives us space to respect their opinions, even if we disagree, and that we validate their experience and not try to minimize it or say something like, you know what, Jaden, just ignore them. They don't know any better. I think in those spaces of trauma, we have to remember that racism is very prevalent and children are experiencing it on the daily. So how do we show our children that we respect and that we can provide safety and validation? For us, it was in that very first moment our son was called the N-word. I knew that I had to up my ante. I needed to up the game, and I needed to do it in a way that was honest, that was age appropriate. But here's the thing, because I can already feel people saying, but I don't want to traumatize them any further. Not talking to your child about race, not adequately preparing them to navigate race in this country will create unnecessary traumas that they won't know how to navigate. So it's a hard ask, but it's something that, you know, as time, as we evolve, we need to take the time to connect the dots on this. Action. If you've been following me on social media for a while, then you'll know that one of the things that I say is that action is love. Without action as transracial adoptive parents, how do we truly say that we are being allies for our children, being advocates for our children? It's easier, right, to advocate for our kids, to take action with a school system that is not equipped to teach them, right? It's easier to redirect people when they say things about our children in regards to they're so lucky they were adopted, which we know shouldn't be the thing we say to our children, right? Because adoption is attached to loss in many ways. But action also requires us to stand in the gap. And standing in that gap, what does that look like when we take action? I can tell you that from my family specifically, one of the things that was very telling for us was when our son was about 10 years old, he got really involved in just trying to learn the politics of the world and kind of define his own Christian worldview. And one of the things that he was really upset about was the gun violence in school systems. The children that were being murdered through gun violence at school. And so we decided to just kind of let him know, you know, this isn't happening at every school. We wanted him to feel safe, but we also wanted him to speak his truth. And so there was a protest, there was a march that he asked us if he could be a part of. They actually shared it at school, and we didn't even know about it. So we went. I had never protested or attended a protest in my life, y'all, like not at all. Neither had my husband. And here we were in the middle of November, freezing rain falling from the sky. My UGG boots were being destroyed by the water. And we stood in those trenches with him. We let him march and yell as loud as he wanted to. You know, we wanted him to know we were with him. We wanted him to know he would not have to face these feelings alone. And that's a way we can show our kids action. But action is also reading the books, mom and dad, becoming educated on what is actually happening in our nation and how that's actually impacting our children. We become their ally. We become their voice when they can't. So love in my family always equals action. To thrive, we had to be okay with being uncomfortable. So living in our community, we were pretty comfortable. My husband and I, we had a beautiful home. We had a great life. We had great friends, and we were comfortable in that life in North Carolina. Here's the thing, though. As my son got older, I noticed him more and more and more uncomfortable. And was I willing to, and again, he couldn't verbalize it, but I could sense it and I could see it. And there were things happening at school and things happening in our community that were just kind of boiling over. And uncomfortable became okay. It became necessary. So we sold everything, right? We relocated. And our first year here in Tampa was really uncomfortable. We were not living in the same space, not in the same community, learning how to adapt to a new world, that almost a world I felt we had left behind in many ways. And being uncomfortable for our child, being uncomfortable in that space, it made all the difference for him. And I think for us, that was the most important thing. Are we able to be uncomfortable so that he can find out who he is, so that he can know that he is loved for who he is? And so for me and my husband, it was a no-brainer. And so we took that year, our first year here in Tampa, and we kind of reconstructed this life and visited churches and, you know, figured out what extracurricular activities he could do, what would he want to be a part of. And even after the pandemic, and even after the shutdown, being uncomfortable was okay because we knew we were in this together. And so, when was the last time you or myself have been made uncomfortable in our transracial adoption journey for our children? We want them to also have comfort. And it's not just, right, the roof over your head. I think that's what relocation taught me. It's not the roof over your head or necessarily the job you have. It's are we together in this? Are we going to change the narrative on how people see families, how transracial adopted kiddos thrive? We did it, and for us, it worked. And I just hope that as you navigate and take away, in closing, all these pieces that we've shared, right, that at the end of the day, our children have experienced trauma. Our children have been made to be uncomfortable. We have the right to give our children a safe environment, a growing community, diversity. We can make all those things happen, and it looks differently for every family. For my family, those were the things that helped. And here's the main takeaway. If you don't hear anything else of what I shared today, I definitely want you to take this away with you. Some people believe that love is enough in adoption. Others believe that love isn't enough. But I believe that love is enough if it's followed by action. Earlier at the beginning of this talk, I mentioned grace, race, and Jesus. And I believe that it's in this last piece that I just shared about love is enough when it's followed by action, that Christ modeled that for us. He was the ultimate model of love in action. And so when we're called to adoption, when we're called to fostering, right, that's our love in action, but it doesn't stop there. Then we've got to dig deep into trauma. We've got to dig deep into, if this child's race is different than mine, we need to have real conversations ongoing about that. It's me standing in the gap for my child in ways that I didn't know that I would have to, or my husband didn't know that he would have to. And it's doing it consistently over and over again until our children can do it for themselves. And so know this, love is enough if you follow it with action. Any help, any support that I can lend in that journey, please feel free to reach out and share with me. And in closing, thank you so much for this opportunity to let me be part of the Insight Conference for the very first time. I would love, 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 love to connect with each and every one of you. Please check out my blog where I share many of these stories and many more. But it's also where you can find my book where I wrote some of the lessons we've learned along the way regarding our son's adoption. And definitely follow me on Instagram. I am at Lihia Speaks, where I am always on, probably a little too much. But I would love to get to know you, get to know your family. And remember, we are in this together. Thank you so much, and I look forward to connecting with you soon.
Thank you for listening to the Honestly Adoption Podcast, a resource courtesy of the Honestly Adoption Company. To learn more about us, visit www.honestlyadoption.com.